And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity. And maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do bleh. Sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
I mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Welcome to the Three Left Show. I hope you can hear me. This is your host, Dan Platt, live in the studio at Grand Street Community Arts. You heard the title card, WCAA, The Voice. I am the Three Left Show. You're about to listen, if you can manage, 2 hours of left-wing radical political talk radio, as the opening montage may have hinted at. We cover issues of socialism, anarchism, ecology, and other radical strategies and practice. But otherwise, I hope they're all doing well this Saturday morning. It is the 20th. I'm always going to open the show with the first segment with more contextual topics, and then the rest will be more less anchored to the circus of the week's news and whatever's on your usual Facebook feed. Get us out of our reality tunnels. That's a term that I like, reality tunnel. You know, we're in a reality. You know, Kanye was talking about infinite universes and whatnot. He kind of meant that we all kind of live in our own reality tunnel. The tunnel's walls are the limits of our experiences. And obviously, to be more well-rounded and more complete and growing people, we want to expand those walls as much as possible until that tunnel perhaps even collapses, or at least has enough room for all of us in it. So, and thus it's not a tunnel anymore. It's more of a kind of big room. So anyway, metaphors aside, I have a few jokey, lighter topics. So if you're not aware, the right wing, the ultra-right, the fascists, the neo-Nazis, they adopted a cartoon from the internet webcomic called Pepe as their mascot. Mascots are fun. They're good to joke around about, and Pepe had a apolitical start. You know, the artist didn't like what happened, but otherwise, in a culture war of sorts, meme war. You know, who can have better memes? Who can maybe who can propagate ideas? You know, these are tools for propaganda and getting people join and just make people laugh and like, oh, these guys are fun, And unfortunately, the left wasn't able to take Pepe back. It was a battleground that we had lost, and there's no point in trying to take that hill. But we have found our Pepe, and he is a man of the people. Oh, you know what? I didn't save the story, but I can recount most of the details. I'll find it again and post it in the synopsis on the Facebook page, Three Left Show, where I put all my sources. And so the Philadelphia, their hockey team, the Flyers, has a new mascot. So this is an actual mascot, not just from the internet, but from the world of sports. And his name is Gritty. And he's like, as described usually, the Muppet from Sesame Street that was kicked out for selling drugs. You know, he's got the big googly eyes, and he's really raggedy, and he's a big monster kind of guy. And so kind of like other baseball mascots and whatnot. And true to these days, meme marketing, you know, he has his own Twitter page, and he was basically threatening another mascot, like a penguin from another hockey team, and basically said, like, you better sleep with one eye open tonight, you know, they were bantering on Twitter, because that's what mascots do these days, you know, to get rev up energy for the team. And then, you know, it went viral of sorts, at least as far as viral as the guys like me would notice. And because this Moppet guy is, you know, making threats. And, oh, yeah, of course, the PR for the new mascot is that he is mischievous. And a guy, you know, in Philadelphia has that blue collar working class culture to it. It's milieu, it's overall culture. And so, like, it's like, you know, this is our guy, Comrade Gritty. You know, he'll go in the streets and he'll fight the fash with us. And so now there's all these memes of Gritty being edgy, you know, doing edgy memes, edgy meaning uncomfortable, violent imagery. You know, there's a spectrum of media, you could call it all media, but particularly memes, is there is the edgy, which is the uncomfortable and the challenging, and usually involves violent and imagery that makes one uncomfortable in many, many ways. And then there's wholesome, which makes you feel good and is very comfortable, you know, Disney type imagery, no violence, no sex or sexual imagery. So there's a spectrum of that, and you can have things in the middle, like cartoon violence, I guess. And then, you know, you can also apply a different spectrum of, what is the other spectrum? There's edgy and wholesome. Oh, yeah. And then the other one is like a dank and normie, which is the, is this cartoon cool? This piece of media, is it cool? Is it, or, you know, is it doing something interesting and new and is fresh? Or is it something that's set in accepted norms? When we say normie, it's just mainstream. It's like, could someone who has a mainstream understanding of media and maybe only watches one movie a year, could they get this joke? You know, versus the dank, which is like the feel special of like it's part of the subculture, right? It's more specific. So a Gritty meme where he's one is. It's a cartoon of the French Revolution. Someone's in a guillotine, a noble, or what have you, and maybe you put a different face on. You know, you Photoshop a face over on the person in the guillotine. Maybe it's a right winger. Maybe it's Trump, what have you. And the executioner says, "Any last words?" And they say, "So much for the tolerant left." And then they get their head cut off. So that would count as a dank and edgy meme. Edgy because, well, someone being executed, and it's kind of the irony, you know, of like, you know, we're called the left, we're so intolerant. It's like, oh, you say you're tolerant, but you're not. Well, yeah, we're not tolerant of fascism and authoritarians crap and the starving of children and the growing homelessness. We're not tolerant of these societal problems, and we'd like to solve them with the means at our disposal, which there are many. And later on, I will get to strategy and tactics, but this hour will focus on, I want to cover a general topic of social welfare funds and then some tenants union fighting back against gentrification in Chicago, I believe. I'll go into that story. This is in the context of last week's show where I talked about economic history, as well as in the beginning of last week's show, employee stock ownership plans, where employees are given by the boss stock in the company, so they feel like they're part owners, and they are thus empowered. Just like, well, see, the work you do for the company does in fact benefit you. The good of the company is the good of you, which is not actually normally the case. The company can keep growing and your wages can stay the same. If you have stock in the company, if the company does well, well, at the very least, your retirement savings certainly grow at a higher rate. You don't actually have voting power over your stock shares. They're in a fund, you know, and they might even be like abstention votes, you know. And that's something that if we were to have real worker ownership of the economy, so I'm going to discuss like kind of this is a more acceptable way of doing it. You know, we socialists talk about, we use the phrase seize the means of production. To clarify, means of production refer to the workplaces, the factories, the land, the things that could be managed collectively or in a by a community organization in ways that are more familiar to us, like this building that I'm in is a community-run enterprise. It's a nonprofit, and there may be various projects within this building. Any workplace is the same, doing projects, and it can be community-run by a group. And, of course, the management and the governance can be a bit messy at times, but it's never true chaos, and things do, in fact, get done in the end if there are the resources to do it. Usually infighting occurs when there's lack of resources and a lack of a vision and a direction. We have those here. We're going to get more resources. You know, in the last few years, we haven't. And so there's been a lot of fighting over how to get those resources, you know, what we have to do first, what to focus on. Some of us have always felt we need to develop the station and the programming in it so that then we can get underwriters and people who actually want to support us and materially. And others is like, no, we have to do all the outreach first now for money, and then we can develop programs. Well, they need something they can see and hear, you know, programs. So I always suck my neck out for the last year to put this out there. Canada just, they're on the road to legalizing pot. Keyword legalize. I don't know what the overall thinking is, but I think because of the shifting norms and the fights that have occurred in various states, similar to gay marriage, not gay rights, because we don't really still have gay rights, but gay marriage, more or less, and that they can't hold the justification anymore of why pot is illegal. If they were ever to admit, and this is something that I think I shared this already, I did, that you know, pot is illegal because alcohol prohibition ended. And the agency that was created to enforce alcohol prohibition wanted to keep their jobs, so they chose a different drug to go after. And that has been the case ever since. After all, if corporations can now profit from selling pot, and which was a concern of legalizing pot, weed, marijuana, on the left, I remember 6 years ago, it was the Best of the Left podcast. Check it out if you really want an introduction to a wide array of center-left media. I don't anymore. Oh, actually, I don't even know if it's still going. But center-left, but it goes back many years. And there was a, you know, and he has call-in segments and the, as I hope to, and it was a conversation about legalizing marijuana and fear of that it'll just become another, like, big tobacco that'll be legalized. And because of our market system, you'll have, well, as any normie media will tell you about, ganjapreneurs, rich white men who have a capital to go over all the hoops and file all the paperwork, especially when these legalization efforts put up barriers that, you know, you need to file for marijuana selling licenses that are $50,000. And they state, you know, like, we're going to put the drug dealers out of business. Now, the drug dealer's crime, and I'm talking about pot dealers in particular, but it goes for any hard drug as well, is, you know, there's a lot of negative effects of illegal, you know, hard drugs and their use and the ability to be addicted to them. But a lot of these effects stem from inequality, that they are illegal. Thus, you can't get good proper medical treatment when you are addicted or affected by them. You can't go to police or the justice system in any fashion when you have a disagreement with someone. Thus, you have to solve it by other means, violence and organized violence via gangs. So on and so on. So is it the selling of the drugs themselves that is immoral? And I'm not talking about the law now, morality, right? why do we want to put drug dealers out of business? If we just legalize it and then they can pay for a, you know, reasonable, like a liquor license, a pot selling license, then now the black market is now a regular market. Because as far as blighted neighborhoods concerned, you know, the jobs available are the jobs that are illegal. They're jobs that have, you know, jobs exist when there's a demand. And but it's just a matter of the state deciding what is a legitimate job and what isn't. And usually, and in most, in many cases, what is decided between legal and not legal is that there is the person making the law or the person who pays and contributes to the campaign of those who make the law to enforce a monopoly for them, or at least to have more control over the market they operate in, and they don't want competition. You know, usually it's brought up, Big Pharma does not want legal pot because pot solves a lot of medical maladies. Talk about pot legalization. So there are demands, strong demands that we community-minded people can make when it comes to when there is pot legalization on the table. In New York, you know, I'm not going to use New York as an example, but certain things to look out for and to look for as far as like, okay, is this something that you can get behind? There needs to be the ability to grow your own. In Vermont, you can't sell, but you can grow your own pot and share it. That's acceptable to me, because to me, it's the priority when it comes to various issues. It's not whether or not someone can make money off of it and employ others, but can we actually provide for ourselves? Can be made available? And of course, putting something on a market certainly does make something more available. So in that case, I will always side with my local activist friend Kate, who has been a drug dealer in the past, and that she is for decriminalization, which is that we simply make it not illegal anymore. It doesn't have to be legalized so that it can then be, pot can then become a corporate industry and have all the problems and entail all the injustices of any other corporate industry. We then have to resist on the ground level. But simply that we can have the drug economy we have now, but without the ill effects of not being able to get medical care, not being able to go to the justice system for disagreements, and so on and so on. I think the other issue is then the safety kind, so the ability to regulate it, and that's where legalization comes in. I think the pot bill just puts pot under the same kind of regulation as alcohol, which is probably the best version of that, considering what we have now where, you know, say what Michigan did where like, or Washington State, we're only going to hand out 30 licenses or limit licenses to each area, the number of pot sellers, and, you know, there can only be two, so we're going to create a false scarcity. That's what that's called, making a false scarcity. Having seeming like there's less of something. So then you sell these licenses for amazing amounts of money rather than having many for less.
If they would tear your world apart, would you intervene? Music is a weapon. Sounds like a threat. Let the bass terrorize their snow. Turn them back!
you. Pressure in the street, dies a slow death. The last world record, save your breath. No lessons learned yet, the death of this guest. Leg on top of left, burning fish net.
So, thank you back. This is the Three Left Show, Radical Talk Radio, Leftist Politics. And I'm going to focus on some activism now from a tenants union in Chicago, the Autonomous Tenants Union. So, three buildings, one struggle against displacement in a neighborhood called Albany Park. Appropriate. I'm broadcasting from Albany, but not Albany Park. Sub-banner, while cities, so I'm going to start reading now. While cities across the U.S. deal with unprecedented housing crisis, management companies and luxury developers get rich off mass displacement, also known as gentrification. In Albany Park, Chicago, one of the most diverse working class neighborhoods in the country, gentrification, okay, using the word, has begun tearing through communities largely unnoticed. While city council people cheer on new business and development, Ron Abrams, the managing broker of Silver Property Group, one such company among many, has taken on the mantle of the eviction king of Albany Park. Here we trace the connections between three of the many mass evictions Silver has carried out and their community resistance against mass displacement. I think if this was a developing country, it would be called genocide of some sort, mass displacement. Or they would be made refugees. If you were paying attention to that ad council piece, you know, that guy wasn't born a refugee. Well, similarly, you're not born poor. You are made poor and kept poor by our capitalist system. I'm going to state that as a fact. In July of 2017, Rob Abrams of Silver Property Group rubbed shoulders with the 33rd Alderman, Deb Mell. Silver had completed renovations of its property at 3001 St. West Lawrence and was receiving a $20,000 rebate check from the local Chamber of Commerce as part of a facade beautification program. Many neoliberal cities have this. It's basically all of the housing investment they're able to seem to be put into. Things aren't all big checks and smiles down the street, however, because up at 4500 North Albany Avenue, just days earlier, Silver Property Group has served long-term Albany Park tenants 30-day notices. So you have that dichotomy there. Two things that are vastly different, but connected. The storefront at 3001 West Lawrence was improved, though its tenants, a storytelling event company and craft coffee roaster, feel a little more wicker than Albany Park. This building, I don't know what that means. This building is one of at least 17 that the company has purchased in Albany Park in the last 6 years. The disconnect between these two scenes is jarring. But one need not even travel those few blocks to learn that evictions are an integral part of their business model. Doubled rents or nothing. The celebration at 3001 West Lawrence, so you have this hippie business going in, or hipster business going in, was also the site of a mass eviction in 2014, just months after they bought the 32-unit courtyard building. An estimated 170 Park households, most of them low-income immigrants, many undocumented, and families with young children, have been displaced following Silver's building purchases, which are then superficially renovated with $20,000 facade grants and put back on the market at much higher rates. In the case of 3001 West Lawrence, Album and Mel used the language of problem buildings to justify the mass eviction, invoking fear of gangs. In a puff piece about Silver's plans to renovate, Mel's chief of staff at the time, Dana Fritz, talked about the building's graffiti, broken doors, and horror stories from the neighbors. Sound familiar? So it's to me. Then Rob Abrams is quoted as saying he wants to make it safer for everyone. Everyone who's, except those who currently live there. It should be noted that while many people were interviewed for this piece, not one was a tenant of the building in question. What would the tenants have had to say about their own homes, or who was responsible for the state the building was in? Important questions local newspapers do not cover. Why? Because the last newspapers left are corporate newspapers. In reality, and they're in their own reality tunnel, as it were. A reality where poor people are always helped by this gentrification and questions of being evicted and are they being made safer? Why not just spend the money to make people safer? Oh, you can't make money off of that. While writing down here, I thought to myself about that, you know, the city or anyone particular, I mean, there's one exception, I guess, but building and renovating all of the vacant properties in Albany, building affordable, rather attainable housing, isn't usually done because tourists don't take their picture in front of affordable housing. That was what I saw. Because when I write down, I'm passing by a few landmarks, and on a Saturday such as this, there were some people doing some selfies in front of them. And it just made me think of, like, yeah, the city's priority, and not just my city, but I'm sure any liberal city, puts more attention on attracting tourists and people of middle-class incomes than actually helping the people of lower class. Certainly, token amounts of money are spent. But when it comes to actual policy, it's austerity, full stop. The economic and psychological stress, back to the article, of these evictions weighed heavy. From families with small children moving in winter nights to an elderly tenant that had lived in the building for decades, deciding to move back to Mexico. Oh boy, I guess the Trumpers would be happy with that. During their last couple of months in the building, only a handful of tenants remained, weathering both the eviction proceedings and horrific conditions caused by the construction that Silver had already started. This is what Silver Property means when they promised to make buildings... Oh, sorry, it's friends of the question. It's in bold, so I wanted to read it. Is this what Silver Property means when they promise to make buildings safer for everyone? In the end, the landlord responsible for the building's problem status, problems in quotes, was allowed to make a good profit by selling the Silver, who renovated the units and put them back on the market at increased rents, leaving tenants that had no control over the building's conditions to pay the price. Silver is known to double rents in some required buildings, with one bedrooms going to $1,200, two bedroom, blah, blah, blah. Oh, sorry, they went from $1,200 to $1,500? Oh, I'm sorry. No, those were the original prices, $1,200 and $1,500. That's what they went up to, which is far from affordable. Because if you'd say you have minimum wage job, even if you have two of them, I think $600, $800 is as far as you can go. Christatina Tenants Union. Okay, on to the resistance. Many of the tenants from 3001 West St. Lawrence scrambling for affordable housing in the aftermath of their eviction were forced to leave the neighborhood. One tenant, Patricia, and her family were lucky enough to find an apartment in gentrifying Albany Park on North Christiana. In a cruel turn, Silver Property purchased that building too. There is no escape from capitalism, at least until you organize against it. Here we are beginning to see a pattern, another building of exclusively Latinx families victimized by this property group. After 5 months of ignoring tenants' repair requests, neglecting the building, it becomes a problem building because they don't maintain it. I mean, that's the tragedy of all the housing projects. So it's like, oh, state housing can't work. State housing was massively underfunded, right? Underfunded to the point where, yeah, they couldn't afford to fix the elevators and fix broken lights. You know, it just gets worse and worse. And then it falls over. It becomes unlivable, despite what everyone wants. Patricia put her experience fighting Silver to use and promptly organizing her neighbors. In this case, the Albany Park community pushed for negotiations. Neighbors on the same block as the tenants rallied around their cause, and the principal of the local elementary school also stepped up to help mediate negotiations and protect her students. 30 children living in the building were enrolled at Hilbert at the time. Side note, this is a good example of branching out and finding solidarity. These issues affect all of us, and they may affect more people than just you and the people in your immediate area. So when you're organizing or thinking about organizing And it's like, well, how big could we really get, you know, my small shop or, you know, my small group of block, you know, go to other community institutions like schools, libraries. And because when it comes to mass resistance, mass movements, they're not mass until all of these entities are in, that they're like the schools say and their administrators, no longer adversaries say, yes, these are our students, this is our tax base, this is our, you know, it's maybe of course the school district would rather have more middle class people, and they don't want to just serve poor students anymore, right? They want more tax base, and so they would be supportive of all of this evictions. I know there's kind of a strain of that in liberal cities like my own. In the end, 15 tenants signed agreements with Abrams for extra time in their building prior to the court process. This is after a press conference, slew of press conferences, delegations, and worked with lawyers toward building a discrimination case. In the end, 15 tenants signed agreements with Abrams for extra time in the building prior to the court process. That time proved vital, though. Many of these tenants were able to find housing in the community, and their new move-out date fell during the kids' summer break. So, not a total disaster, but still, you can still win something. But Fighting Displacement, subtitle, Fighting Displacement takes more than empty promises. Though she was involved, Alderman Mel acted as a sort of intermediary for Abrams, interjecting in his favor and refusing to leverage for tenants. After their in-person negotiations, Jason Jimenez, Mel's chief of staff, was the person relaying information from Abrams to tenants. Oh, great. What a great messenger. Hernandez had become Abrams' de facto rep, paid for by taxpayers. Abraman Mel's intervention on Silver's behalf shouldn't come as a total surprise. She has received $3,300 in campaign contributions. And by the way, side note again about power and representation. If we had income-based taxes, where even lower class people are contributing into the tax base instead of just property owners. Because as it is, you know, representatives will say explicitly they serve taxpayers, right? So if you're too poor or working class and you're not paying local property taxes, please just assume they're not serving you. They don't have your interest. They're not going to, and they materially can't have your back. Because it's you versus the property owner. And unless you think those interests can be the same or aligned, which good luck with that, then local representation is always going to be in favor of property taxes. So if you want better representation, it's not just a matter of voting the bums out. There needs to be a fight to change the tax system. The way local government is funded, I'm not covering modern monetary theory here, but the ideas were cropping up in the last week. I was watching and listening to some interviews because they've been making a PR push that, you know, any money the government spends is always a guess. You know, they create the budget before they've collected the taxes. So just think on that. That's not the other way around. It's not based on how much revenue they bring in. It's based on how much the government wants to spend. So if they want to spend enough to build out housing, right, with the expectation that then there will be more value and more taxation to happen later. It's all a matter of projection, but hey, that's what all budgets are. They formed tenants unions. One's called the Sunnyside Manor Tenants Union and concentrated their efforts on simply trying to get a meeting with their absent landlord. They even employed Mel to pursue Abrams, but she took a disempowered stance once again, making empty promises and failing to arrange a meeting. So Sunnyside tenants fight them. Abrams, running out of time here, unfortunately. I can't go through all the details of their struggle. Here's a bold text here. In the midst of Chicago's housing crisis, many groups are proposing policy consolidations. Consolations. Just cause eviction law, rent control, more democratic zoning process. But when our leaders refuse to make examples of billionaire developers like Ron Abrams, it's clear where their loyalties lie. Perhaps these low-income tenants are unable to cut male fat campaign checks the way Abrams has, but their presence is what makes up the fabric of Albany Park, one of the country's most diverse and vibrant neighborhoods. This is kind of repeating that. Yeah, and that's just kind of a statement. So his decision to file eviction before even meeting with the tenants' union will put a mark on their renting history, affecting their chances of finding affordable housing in the future, even if they win their court case. At present, tenants are awaiting jury selection for their next hearing. Despite the risk of going through a court process poses, the tenants continue fighting to remain in their homes. I think I'll finish this out by making a comment that trying to go for these legal procedures is also kind of, it's allowable and acceptable in civil. But I say there's nothing civil about these evictions. There's nothing civil about throwing people out of their homes when they can still pay rent. Doing the best to. They're doing everything right, and they're losing their homes. So why be civil? When you form a tenants union, it's good to demand meetings, but if they don't, if there's no impetus to get a meeting, then you have to sue and be in a court process for years or a year just to get a meeting, just to be told to F off. This is where you create, rent strikes aren't applicable because they don't want your rent anymore. But then it just becomes occupying the building. Occupy the building militantly and getting all of these other entities, getting the school behind you and getting other people and all the businesses on the block and the adjacent blocks. With that kind of support, you're not going to be, raided by the police. You stay put, you create, it becomes like a blockade and you almost kind of, create fortifications around this building because it's a real fight, a fight for our lives, a fight for our homes. And then they're forced, they have to come to the negotiating table because now, cause you get a lot of media attention doing that. And now your press conferences where you get maybe a little blurb in the paper now becomes the front page or maybe the third page, but still. News that becomes noticeable now becomes a real black eye, and it makes the little facade treatment and the new hipster coffee shop look quite meaningless in comparison. Now it becomes reported, and people see you. They see what is happening, the ill effects of, no, this isn't just growing the tax base. This is the destruction of families and lives. And displacement, which in other circumstances would be considered genocide because you are destroying material culture and family structures and ruining their lives and so on. And I went through some details that it disrupts their, it cuts them from getting future housing. These families, 10 years from now, they could be chronically homeless. Why? How are they all homeless? Where all these homeless people come from? Didn't they make the right choices? Well, they tried. But it's not really a matter of choice, usually. It really isn't. Welcome back to the Three Left Show. Taking down the call-in number, 518-375-2141. That is, again, area code 518-375-2141. That is our call-in number. Sticking to it. Please call in if anyone's listening. Don't hesitate. Okay, so I was actually going to cover social wealth funds. I can just cover this quickly. It's a really long article. Maybe I'll come back to it in a future show because it's from a paper. So I'll just give a source now, and I'll link that so it can be read from a kind of left-wing think tank called the People's Policy Project. And they're like center-left, kind of Bernie-crat kind of side of things. And so this is better than the concession that is like the employee stock ownership plan, what I call like fake worker ownership. Because, what's the point of owning if you can't manage it or you don't actually have any power over the business or the company or the firm that you work for? Worker ownership usually implies also worker control. So these things are usually also can also be separated out, and you have to fight for each individual thing. And here, but there are ways of kind of doing things, and it's also kind of maybe a tactic of like there's a moniker of boomers who, you know, former hippies or hippie leaning types who are like, you know, look, we didn't sell out, we bought in. You know, that was kind of maybe a motto from the 70s. And to guys like me, it kind of represents the rationalization of becoming, of not resisting the system anymore. I mean, you resisted as long as you were going to be drafted, but now that once that threat passed, then you can join civil society and be civil and if, oh, all the injustice is okay because it's not happening to me. So I'm just going to do a quick the definition of a social wealth fund, which is basically like a government, municipality, basically buys up stocks, you know, investments in companies. So as the economy grows, the stock market grows, then this fund grows, and then the fund and its dividends, you know, its profit is then and is invested into public projects, public goods of all shapes and sizes, or it's the basis for a basic minimum income, a UBI, universal basic income, like that exists in Alaska. So they use Alaska as so this is a paper, white paper, meaning an academic one. So you need to back up your claim. So they use the cases of in Scandinavia, where Norway, half the economy is basically the social wealth fund. And that's how they fund all of their social programs. It's not really through this extensive taxation and everyone's overtaxed. It's that as Norwegian companies do well, then this fund grows and then they can fund everything with it. Sweden had a worse experience with it. They go into why. It didn't help that in the 80s, like many nations, they were hit with recession. And they've actually been in an austerity economy since then, where even if their center-left party still maintains control, they've been the neoliberal. And neoliberal meaning like our current economic system with its market fundamentalism and austerity politics when it comes to budgets and like, oh, no, we can't spend more than we tax and we don't want to tax more because that'll hurt the economy. Do I need to get into why that's bunk? So it gets into the tactic of like, you know, many corporations, you know, the pension funds themselves are based on investing in the stock market. Now, there's obviously a socialist critique of this, a left-wing critique, that it ties your interests, your material interests, whether it be a basic income or your future retirement, to the growth and maintenance of a capitalist system, which may be constantly reminded is destroying the biosphere and creating climate chaos. Hurricanes are now in the Atlantic, are now going east towards Africa and Spain. And of course, they're getting bigger and badder. And we see those effects as our federal government can't even be bothered to fund relief efforts, creating governmental dead zones from which perhaps a better society can actually grow as we refine community and no longer rely on market mechanisms to get what we need. So, but could this be done by unions of people like this tenants union and so on, and or even just a community group to find a local company that is on the public or just invest in it? I mean, this I suppose is the basis of community loan funds. And which speak for themselves as to the success of keeping dollars local, helping small businesses with a small is beautiful ethos. It's still market-based capitalists and fighting against the current of consolidation, monopoly, and, you know, our plutocratic state, but otherwise doing their best and sort of insulated by local support. But could it be done, like, I think it's been brought up where, you know, let's say a bunch of communists like me buy stocks, and with the dividends from the current system, from the wealth of the current system, we start siphoning it off in our own socialist and anarchist projects to fund ourselves, the buying of land, the creating of communes, creating of our own worker-owned and directed enterprises, and all the things that left-wing economists will talk about but never seem to materialize and are scaled up. But to scale up requires capital stacks. And how do we get them? How do we get the millions and millions of dollars? I mean, it takes $1 million just to renovate a block. And that's if you do it with like a ton of volunteer labor and all that as a nonprofit or something. You know, $2 million seems like a lot of money to an individual. But when it comes to actual public goods, fixing up a park, it goes fast. But related is, so I talked about tenant union, and I failed to find stories of a tenant union, say, buying up the building they live in. But that's the kind of thing that can occur when you stand and fight for that. Or let's say you're not being evicted and it's not in a crisis moment, but people are fed up about a lack of maintenance and all that stuff, and you want to get ahead of it. So you organize a tenants union in your building or block or amongst people around you, and then with shared resources, pool some money together, buy your own buildings, create housing co-ops, which is more difficult up here in upstate New York because we don't have precedents, which means banks don't want to lend to you. Thus, the need for public banking and those community wealth funds to fund these things. So, but workers in Maine, this is the story. Workers in Maine buy out their jobs. So I'm going to use the last 5 minutes to quickly go through this just as an example to get your creative juices flowing. Of workers in Maine buy out their jobs, set an example for the nation. On a remote Deer Isle, Maine, the movement for a more just and democratic economy won a major victory this summer. And by the way, this is from Truthout, September 2014. 4 years ago. I've been holding this to the chest for a long time. That's a great story. Burt Cove Market, a variety and pharmacy, and the Galley, I guess a restaurant, banded together by the stores and create the newest worker cooperative in Maine and the second largest in New England. Now the workers own and run the business together under one banner known as the Island Employee Cooperative. This has been the first time that multiple businesses of this size and scope have been merged and converted into one worker co-op. That makes them stronger, more resilient, I'm sure, making this a particularly groundbreaking achievement. But what did it take to get here? When the local couple that had owned the three businesses for 43 years, so I mentioned this in the previous episode, that, you know, you have boomers who own half the businesses, they retire, and they don't know who to sell to, they have no potential buyers, because, except maybe large corporations, banks, Walmart, or competition. Competition certainly doesn't want to buy you out. That's just more property to manage. And so anyway, 43 years, and they think about selling their stores and retiring, but an alternative is actually to sell to your employees. The stores are one of the island's biggest employers, and a potential buyer probably would not have come from within the community or maintain the same level of jobs and services. Rarely ever happens. Probably impossible to happen. Only a worker buyout could achieve stability. Because these workers were trying to establish something historic, it took more than a year, and it wasn't always an easy road. But the workers' strength lay in their own determination and the ability to rely on a group of allies dedicated to growing the cooperative movement. This included the Independent Retailers Shared Services Cooperative and the Cooperative Development Institute. That is a think tank that helped them with management, governance, and legal and financial documents and structure, figure out how this would actually work. They were also able to secure financing from Maine-based Coastal Enterprises and the Cooperative Fund of New England. So Cooperative Fund, a fund just for cooperatives. Where do they get their funding? Go to their site, find out. Maybe that's something I can dig into. Both community development finance institutions, without that dedicated technical assistance and available capital, it was doubtful that the workers could do the buyout, as anyone knows. While the creation of the IEC, that's the Island Employee Cooperative, maintained dozens of decent-paying jobs and remote communities only nearby access to essentials, I think their remoteness might have also helped. But I think that it goes for any business anywhere. This experience shows that if only we had more resources to experiment with grounded, practical economic policies, we could create many more of the living wage jobs and community-sustaining businesses we desperately need. And it goes into how the recession has made things bad in Maine. It's why they continue to have a butthole governor. The Island Employee Cooperative, a model, and they talk about the model. So, yeah, it just goes into all of the positives of co-ops. I just wanted to get out there of how they did it, that it took this coalition of other groups, charity, you know, part charity, but also, but doing so in solidarity, to help these businesses, the workers there, to buy out when their owner, then their family owned owners retire. So I think this is definitely more possible when it's a nice boomer couple who wants to do the right thing. Probably harder when it's a, let's say, someone who's very profit minded and very much wants to sell to a high, you know, doesn't want to sell down, but wants to create a nice nest egg for themselves, and you have to fight them. So that's a different kind of struggle, but at least when things kind of going downstream for this group, it's a good example of what can be done. Too many examples here in my area of, oh, this business is closing because the longtime owner for 50 years is finally giving it in and retiring. And there's also other pressures. It was a local amusement park, a tiny little amusement park called Hoppin's Playland. And everyone was up in arms, you know, family memories from generations and generations, you know, from since the 50s. And everyone wants to save it, but no one was willing to buy the property. No one was available. No one had the capital to buy the property. No one had the nerve to. The government wasn't going to buy it and make it a public park that and have, you know, public employees run it. No way, that's socializing. So the last resort was having a local business, a warehouse furniture company. They bought the rides and moved the rides to their property. So the rides are maintained and still exist, but the park itself, you know, Hoppin's Playland was called, is no more. Now to replace with bland, suburban, upscale shops and housing, which then kind of build out the suburban area. Now all the people that moved there in the 60s and 70s, you know, refugees of white flight, I guess. Now they don't feel welcome. Like, oh, no, it's too built up. It's too urban. Now I have to go farther out. What a cycle. And then more of our lands are eaten up by sprawl and roads and gas stations, paving paradise, putting up a parking lot, as it were. Quote a pop song. So anyway, that is the end of our first hour. Second hour will be filled to the brim with electoralism. Fair warning. So thank you very much for joining me.
Patroons came from Holland to America. Became landlords where none had been before. Soon one man owned 500,000 acres on both sides of the Hudson River shore. He invited families to move in and give him 30% of everything they grew every year. This is how they pay the rent. His name was Van Rensselaer. He became one of the richest men on earth. In today's terms, $90 billion is how much he'd be worth. All this for doing nothing but saying all of this was his. I have the power of the state behind me, and I'm in the landlord biz. After 200 years of this and one revolution, handsome year, had another son. This Rensselaer was greedier than his ancestors dead and past. It was the 1840s, and things were changing fast. It was the straw that broke the back. The bottle was uncorked. They started organizing meetings, the tenant farmers of New York. They found the strength of numbers. They found the power of suggestion. They found each other asking the same question. Who gave you the right to be a landlord? Come live a life of ease while others toil. Who gave you the right to be a rich man while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? They vowed they would stop the rent collection. They vowed they'd bring this madness to an end. And when one blew the tin horn of distress, he soon found he had a thousand friends. With calico skirts, masks upon their faces, on horseback, armed with knives and guns. They chanted and they yelled, and they kept their farms, and they kept the sheriffs on the run. They asked, who gave you the right to be a landlord? Live a life of ease while others toil. Who gave you the right to be a rich man while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? The governor's militias tried to stop them, but nothing could be done to break their will. And by 1848, the landlords buckled, sold their holdings to the farmers in the hills. Yes, they overthrew this feudal system, but it's replaced now by speculators and banks. And you can still hear the homeless families asking of all the landed gentry in our ranks, who gave you the right to be a landlord? To live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? Who gave you the right to be a landlord? To live a life of ease while others toil? Who gave you the right to be a rich man while the rest of us pay you so we can work this soil? Who gave you the right?